Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
Missing persons take over and we go up there and we talk to him. We go to, I don't know if I could even call it a shack. Oh my God. It was so cold. Oh, it was creepy.
This week, we're delving back into the Narelle Fraser files. This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. Lorraine Carter's troubled life landed on Narelle's desk during her days at the Missing Persons Squad, and it's a case that Narelle is still emotional about today. So you're in Missing Persons.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always fascinated by this thing that, you know, when your radar goes up, when a case comes across your desk in Missing Persons, it makes you go, something more to this, something interesting about this.
Yeah, but sometimes that doesn't actually, sometimes it's not obvious.
Yeah, okay.
Like if you looked at it,
yeah,
you'd, I don't know, it's just sometimes it's an internal thing that goes off. Where
well, you've got such volume in Missing Persons, right? Like it's like 30,000 Australians go missing every year.
Yes.
So there's a, and most of them turn up in 48 hours.
Yep.
So the volume that's coming past your desk is pretty big.
Yep.
And, you know, most of them have just gone somewhere and forgotten to tell anybody or they've gone off in an emotional.
Needing a bit of time on their own or something.
Yeah. Yep. So they'll come back. So, yeah. So in this situation, do you remember?
What happens is the analyst will always go over all the missing persons, and she or he, the analyst at the missing persons unit, they're actually the ones that will weed out what you think are a fairly standard missing person, a 14-year-old that's, you know, having fights with mum and dad, maybe a girl that's met a boy. You know, you look at them and you think, there's just nothing, there's generally not something that really gets your attention. But the analyst will sieve through all those missing persons and they can pick them up pretty good. But then the next level, we all look at them as well as the detectives, we all look at them too. And there's some where the whole lot of us will go, boy, this one's a bit strange, isn't it? And that's how we found this one.
Mm-hmm.
I always call her the lovely Lorraine, but that's how we found Lorraine's one. And sometimes it's just that gut feeling again. You know, you think it's hard to explain. Well, a gut feeling isn't hard to explain. We all know what that is.
Yeah.
But it's a professional gut feeling that you learn to, you know.
Yeah. So who was Lorraine? Lorraine Yardley. Well, Lorraine Carter, right, by this stage was her married name, Nee Yardley.
Yes, well, I suppose I've always ever known her as Lorraine Carter, but she was Lorraine Yardley for most of her life. Lorraine was born in 1958, but when she was born, she was her parents' only child, June and Alan, the lovely June and Alan. And Alan had been married before. He had a couple of daughters, but it was June's first marriage. Anyway, when Lorraine was born, Lorraine had complications and she really had difficulties from the start. She had a hare lip, a cleft palate. She had heart and hearing problems. She had intellectual difficulties. She was educated at a special school and she really struggled academically. And look, it's just so unfortunately typical, isn't it, that somebody that's a little bit different, they get bullied and they get teased. And that's unfortunately what happened with Lorraine. But Lorraine was very, very fortunate in a lot of ways. Like maybe she certainly wasn't fortunate with what, I'm not a religious person, but I was just going to say what God had given her. But she was very fortunate with the parents, that with June and Alan. All kids love their parents, I know that. But with special needs kids, it takes a really special sort of person, doesn't it, to deal with it all. And I've always admired June and Alan because they gave her every opportunity. They adored her, but she really, you know, she struggled. As a child, Lorraine was assessed as probably never attaining an intellectual level above 10 years of age. However, she really defied that, and I think that's because she had the unwavering support of her mum and dad. Mm. Look, Lorraine, I think it would be fair to say, Lorraine wasn't a Rhodes Scholar, but she certainly was able to look after herself reasonably well, other than finances. But she's certainly not the Lone Ranger there, is she? Yeah. So she lived with her parents most of her life. She held a couple of part-time jobs, but she received a pension. She was on a disability pension. And as I said, she managed pretty well. She could look after herself. Like, her parents went away one time when she was, oh, I don't know, maybe late 20s. And she managed for 6 weeks on her own, apart from the finances. So she could manage reasonably well. I'm aware that she had a couple of short relationships. She was unlucky in love. She's like all of us. She just wanted to meet someone. Mm-hmm. And ultimately she, you know, would love the thought of getting married. Anyway.
Where were they living?
She was actually lived in Wantirna for most of her life.
Right.
So she was a city girl.
Right, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So still most women, I guess, born in that era sort of thought that they'd grow up and get married and have a family. That was common, yeah.
Your parents were very, you meet a man, you marry him, you have kids and life goes on happily ever after.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she was in Wantirna, and then I think they moved to Bendigo maybe, something like that. And she had a few short relationships, but she was unlucky in love. But then when she met Murray, which we're going to talk about, she became even unluckier. Going back, there's not much more I can say. I learnt all this through, obviously, meeting June and Alan. Mm. When that job came across our desk, the first thing we do when we get that, not only the gut feeling, but then you start to have a little bit of a cursory look, and you look at, say, the bank accounts, you look at a little bit about the husband or the partner, just do a little bit of family history, and that's when things start adding up. You know, it might be only a little one percenter, but then something else happens. And you know how I keep talking about those ticks?
Yeah.
You know, so you get a tick, yes, she hasn't accessed her bank account, which was very unusual. She hadn't accessed Centrelink, all that sort of stuff. So you start to, you know, that there is something not quite right. So the bosses make the decision as to which jobs we take on. With this one, it was pretty quick. They said, yep, we need you to go out and speak to Lorraine's parents. They were living in Wantirna, and we need you to get as much information as you can, just get a bit of a feel for the job itself.
Were they the ones who called it in?
Alan, yes. Alan was the one that initially reported Lorraine missing. And we got the job in, I think it was 2001, but Alan had reported her missing about 4 months prior. So it took a while for us to get the job because the locals did a lot of work initially. Like, we monitored.
Okay.
And the locals did, you know, they did a lot of work, but they got to the point where they didn't really know, there wasn't much more they could do. And that's when often they will bring in, when they start to think, I think there's something a bit more. This is not just a missing person. This is looking like a possible murder. That's when they call us in, the experts, because we've got time, we've got the resources.
Wow.
And, you know, we just sort of really, it sounds a bit bragging, but when missing persons or homicide ring, say, search and rescue.
Yeah, right.
Or the soggies.
Yeah, they jump.
They jump.
Yeah, right. But when Wantirna local coppers ring, they don't.
Yeah, they've got to go through the hoops, which is fair enough. But
then by the time you come on board, she's been gone 4 months.
I think it was about that.
It feels like sort of
a bit behind the eight ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Initial evidence, like her home, her car, if I don't know if she had a car, but like her bedroom, her drawers, her personal effects. Yep.
Although the locals had done quite a lot.
Okay.
We really couldn't. Remember one time I was telling you about, sometimes with a missing person, it's difficult because you've got to establish whether an offence has occurred.
Yeah.
So sometimes it might take you a lot longer than you'd expect, than the public would expect.
Yeah, I guess.
To actually establish whether an offence has occurred or not.
Can you legally blow in there into the house? So by this stage, she's married to Murray? Is this right?
No. Yes, I beg your pardon. She'd been married only about 12 months, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So can you, you know, walk into their house and treat it like a crime scene? I guess not.
No, I've got to have a warrant.
Right, yeah. So you can't just go in there and start investigating.
No, we could certainly go in there and, you know, knock on the door and,
yeah,
hi Murray, we're from Homicide, wondering if we could have a bit of a chat to you about Lorraine. If he says, yeah, sure, come in, which most of them do, we'd go in, we'd have a bit of a chat, but to actually, and you know, you might have a cursory look around, but when you start opening people's drawers, when you start, you know, upending the bedroom, looking under the mattress, all that sort of stuff, you can't, like, that's invading somebody's privacy. Like, they're basic human rights. You wouldn't do that. And you apply for that, what I was saying the other week, a Section 465 evidence warrant.
Okay.
And that legally gives you the authority to search inside the roof cavity if you need to. Like in this case, I will go through it, but in this case, we actually pulled up some boards on the front veranda because we were concerned that Lorraine might be under the boards. So you wouldn't do that without a warrant because you've got to be covered legally. And I think that's fair enough. I think if there was no warrants in this world, it would be unfair.
Yeah, I guess just by the time you and I are talking about it, I've got the benefit of hindsight and I'm thinking, yeah, but it's 4 months later, Narelle. Like, he could have done anything in that time, you know. He could have scrubbed the place down and taken stuff away. And
Look, I think it's 4 months, but as we go through, it'll probably become more evident. We'll go back.
Yep.
So we've been out to June and Alan's house, right? This is... I think it's about 4 months later, but we'll clarify that later. So we go out and speak to June and Alan, and this is where we start to get into the real nitty-gritty. We grind down into all the very personal stuff. What do they think happened?
God,
why do they think...
beside themselves by this stage.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
They were. It's a very difficult thing to do to walk into somebody's place and, oh, hi, I'm Narelle Fraser. I'm from the Missing Persons Unit.
Yeah.
The minute you say that, they must... no, wow, this is getting pretty serious. You know, this isn't just the local detectives now. These are, you know, from the Homicide Squad, Missing Persons Unit. But they were very welcoming. But this is where you get all that information and you ask a lot of questions. Often these interviews will last at least a couple of hours.
Mm.
You take a lot of notes. They give you, on this particular day, I remember they gave us a number of photos of Lorraine, so that we had a, like, it's, if you're just hearing about somebody, it's awkward or uncomfortable maybe about, oh, poor Lorraine, but when you actually see a photo, it really makes it real, you know, not that we don't think it's real, obviously, of course, but when you see that photo. Anyway, so they showed us the photo and I've got to say it was very obvious that Lorraine had intellectual difficulties, but she was just adored by her parents and probably a bit more so because she had difficulties, you know, so they really did have to look after her. Well, she couldn't really.
She was a vulnerable person.
Vulnerable. That's a good word.
So
she
normally
was
an
so
adult,
vulnerable.
You know, normally by the time a person is that age, their relationship with their parents is not that close, I guess.
Yeah.
But in their situation, it was still very close.
Oh, very much so. And that's a very good word. She was just so vulnerable.
Yeah.
So they give us the information. And what they say is that in 1998, they purchased a caravan. Mm. And they used to take it down to Phillip Island and they stayed down there a lot with Lorraine. Lorraine loved it down there. So they'd go down there a fair bit. Lorraine would love it so much that sometimes she didn't want to come home. And I think she just loved... well, she probably loved the independence of, she wanted to stay on her own in the caravan. So her mum and dad allowed her to do that. Well, not allowed, you know, let her do that.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would have been a little bit with a heavy heart. Just, you know, I hope she's okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so in 2000, Lorraine tells June and Alan that she's met a man at the caravan park and his name was Murray. And Murray owned an on-site van at the same caravan park. He was 11 years older than her, but a relationship very, very quickly formed and Lorraine actually moved into the caravan with Murray.
Mm.
So I suppose that would be a worrying time, I suppose, for June and Alan.
Mm.
But we find out a little bit about Murray. I can't say June and Alan were particularly taken with him, but it probably didn't help but for the fact that in Murray's late teens, his name was Murray Carter, and in his late teens, he was jailed for 5 years for car thefts and robbery. Now, the robbery was quite violent and he hit a shop attendant over the head with a spanner. Now, to spend 5 years inside, you've got to have done something pretty bad, particularly as a young, I think he was only about 17.
Yeah.
So that would have had to have been pretty bad. But anyway, he was paroled in 1969 and he married his girlfriend at the time. Her name was Cheryl. They'd been seeing one another for quite a while. And in fact, Cheryl gave birth to their first child when Murray was in jail. But after 35 years, they separated. But this was mainly due to the fact that Murray in 1996, I think it was, he had a brain aneurysm. Mm. And what happened is his personality completely changed. He became very abusive. He yelled, just completely different personality. But even before he changed as such and he had the brain aneurysm, Cheryl had said that he was a very controlling man. He controlled all the finances. Cheryl said he had a number of affairs. She's very aware of a number of affairs that he had. He ostracised her from her family, mm-hmm. who she had been very close to prior to meeting Murray. He'd worked as a manager at a transport company in Sydney, so he had a pretty good job until he had the aneurysm and then things completely changed. But the family got to the point where they could no longer tolerate his behaviour and he was asked to leave the family home, which he did. He tried to return a couple of times, but they'd had enough of him. There were all sorts of allegations also about historical sex abuse and physical assaults against a family member by Murray. He was so abusive after his aneurysm, he became so abusive and threatening that the family were so terrified they actually had to go to court and get an order, mm. which was granted. So all these things, this is exactly what he did with Lorraine too.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the June and Alan were so worried because Lorraine used to ring them every day. She had a mobile phone which was like her security blanket and she rang them every day, happy as Larry down there, and she'd met Murray and everything was, you know, roses for a while. But then June and Alan noticed that the phone calls became very intermittent. Lorraine wasn't ringing them very much. He was sort of ostracising her from all her friends. She had some lovely friends. She had grown up with friends that she had met at her special school that were very, very dear friends to her. So he had taken her away from all that. So everything that Lorraine grew up with, Murray took her away from it.
Isolating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. So they've been living together at the caravan park in his caravan for not very long. And in 2001, they moved to Cape Patterson into a house, Lorraine and Murray. And this is where things turned really bad. Neighbours started reporting, hearing really loud arguing, yelling and screaming. Police went a number of times. The friends and neighbours began to notice that the relationship was very violent and they started seeing injuries to Lorraine. Lorraine would often ring her parents and she was hysterical because Murray had been abusive to her. And anyway, look, it's easy to say now, but unfortunately, in 2001, in July, Murray asked Lorraine to marry him and she did. Apparently, the marriage, the day was beautiful.
Yeah.
All her friends came, her mum and dad were as proud as anybody would be. But from that day on, it just got worse and worse. His controlling of her became very sort of difficult to ignore and the violence actually escalated. This is like almost days after the wedding.
Mm.
And Lorraine told her mum one time when she rang her that he'd been hitting her with a chair and that they were fighting constantly. But this was corroborated really by the neighbours. And by this stage, June and Alan would often ring the neighbours or the neighbours would ring June and Alan to say how worried they were. Like, what a terrible position all you want for your kids is for them to be happy and safe.
Yeah. And I mean, Lorraine's in her 40s.
Yeah, I
know. At this stage, you know. She's not a baby. She's not a child, even though we know she's vulnerable.
Yeah.
What are they to do?
I know. They can't do anything. But
I'm sure they've given her every option. I'm sure they've said to her, you can come home anytime, we'll come and get you, and done all those things that
pleaded with her families to come home.
Do, yeah.
But you're right. It's just I feel for everyone out there that has those, any time your kids leave you, I imagine it would be, or they go out for the night, you know, you lie awake at night worrying whether they're going to come home and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But to actually have somebody so vulnerable and now they have no, they've got no responsibilities for Lorraine anymore because it's all with Murray.
Yeah.
Like Lorraine has chosen Murray, you know, Murray's chosen her, so they've got to let go. I mean, how would you ever do that?
Mm.
So I can't imagine if your daughter rings and says, Mummy's hitting me with a chair, I just can't imagine how that must.
No.
Oh, you'd just want to go and grab her and take her away, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And what happens, do you know, if the family phone the local police and say, my daughter's being assaulted by her husband, the police go to the address, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Is it then up to the daughter, the victim, to press charges? What can you do in that situation?
What the police should do, it's very easy to say what you should do.
Yeah.
But when you've got a report of an assault, of course you'd go round.
Yeah.
But if you saw any signs of any assault, what you should do is actually go to the court and get an intervention order. If it's late at night, there's these safety, I don't know if they've got them now, but there's safety notices now where you can order somebody to leave the house, like they could. If that happened now, you could.
So I'm just thinking, if we have listeners now who either have this happening to a family member or a neighbour or whatever, can you kind of anonymously call the police to go around to that address?
Look, you can.
Mm.
But if you give a name and a number, that just gives it more credibility.
Okay.
But the police, if you say, you know, that you can hear yelling and screaming, the police have a responsibility to go around and make sure that everything is all right, because often there is situations, particularly in family violence, and there would be a lot of listeners, well, hopefully not too many, that have experienced family violence.
Yeah.
And for somebody to ring themselves, you can't actually do it because it's, you know, the whole, then your whole world collapses.
Yeah.
It's
and even sometimes in a family, like sometimes people feel like they can't phone and tell the police that their sister's husband is bashing her because then their sister will never speak to them again or whatever.
That's right.
You know.
So you can understand everyone's point of view, but that's why it's so important to ring the police, because they go in and, look, you could actually say to the police, look, it's my next-door neighbour, I'm worried, I can hear yelling and screaming.
Yeah.
But I suppose ultimately there's a bit of responsibility, isn't there, in the community. It's easy to say, but if you do hear something and let's say it does get to court, sometimes you may be called as a witness.
Yeah.
But I suppose you've got to have the courage of your convictions, don't you? And you think, well, yes, I've caused a bit of a rift, but I might have saved
a life,
somebody from being pummeled.
Yeah, that's right. And certainly in the moment you could be saving a life.
Absolutely. Yep. So the police have a responsibility, absolutely, to go and make sure everything's okay. And often you'll go, as a police person, you'll go, and I've had a number of, too many to recall, but where you'll go and you'll say to the woman, is everything okay? And she'll go, yes, but you know it isn't.
I know. Yeah.
So what you do is you can go back to the office of police and you can, do all sorts of things to flag that address to say, if you're called to this address again, or, you know, get around there quickly.
Right.
So you can put it on our system, on the LEAP system, that there's issues there. We've got a very vulnerable woman or a vulnerable son or whatever.
Great. So that if the next time she is ready to say, no, everything's not okay here, then there is a record of previous visits.
Yes.
Okay.
Police are supposed to record every job that they go to, what happens, who they speak to, what action was taken.
Because unfortunately, I feel like the media is full of stories from 10, 20, 30 years ago where nothing happened. And I think we need to keep reminding people that that's not the process anymore.
No.
That police are very much more proactive now and they will go there and do something. They will, you know.
In fact, it's legislated. Yeah. I believe it's now legislated that as a police person, you have a responsibility to make sure that person's safe. And if they are not, it doesn't matter what they say. If they have a black eye and you are, you know, pretty sure that it's somebody in the house, you have a obligation to get an intervention order.
Great.
And sometimes it's the police's intervention that actually can break that cycle, because then the offender might start to think, God, I'm really losing control here. And police don't just go in to, our job is not to go in and break up the family. It's to try and actually keep them together. So you can, as a police person, there's a lot of avenues. You can get them, you can get them counselling, you can get them mediation. Like there's lots of things as a police person that you can do to help. It's not all about the police are coming and they're going to break up our family.
Yeah.
Often that's what is needed to break that cycle.
Yeah. After the break, Narelle takes us through the investigation into Lorraine's disappearance. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Narelle Fraser takes us deep into the country to Murray and Lorraine's isolated farmhouse.
But we're going back now to the early 2000s when poor June and Alan are getting phone calls from their daughter Lorraine.
Yep.
Who won't leave her husband Murray,
nope,
but is phoning them sometimes, and her neighbours are phoning them sometimes to say it's happening again.
Yep. The neighbours, by this stage, they've also actually rescued Lorraine quite a few times from the house.
Oh, my goodness.
They've taken them into their house, and there was one time when the neighbours were so shocked at Lorraine's injuries that they said that she'd had a hell of a hiding, and she had scratches, she had bruises, she had swelling to her face, to her body. Like, just what a...
brutal.
It's a no-win, is it, for anyone but poor Lorraine. And Lorraine apparently told the neighbours that she had been thrown across a room against a cupboard. Lorraine was a little, tiny little woman, and Murray was a big bloke. Like he used to be a truck driver, I think. So he was a big bloke. So, you know, to throw little, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned because obviously there's people out there that will be listening and they're people that will have gone through this.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose my message, our message to them is that you don't have to put up with that. You've got to break that cycle at some stage or you will end up like Lorraine.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where Lorraine is. Lorraine is actually missing. We believe she's murdered.
Mm.
And that's because, well, it's not because nobody did anything, but Lorraine reached out to so many people. Her parents, you know, people tried everything, but I think looking back, if there was some professional intervention early in the piece, it's easy to look back now and, you know, say, why didn't they do this and do that? I don't know. But if it happened now, I'd be very, very disappointed if police turned around and didn't do anything.
Mm.
Well, they're mandated to do something now. Anyway, so Lorraine's in, you know, a world of pain, of trauma. And, like, the neighbours were talking about seeing raw skin. You know, like, you just can't imagine. Lorraine also had attended lots of counsellors, sexual assault people up where she was living, seeking refuge, seeking assistance. Murray was just so volatile and so abusive, but she kept returning to him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never been in that situation, so I'm not saying I understand. However, I do get the point that people return because there's so many reasons why they return. It might be financial, it might be support in all sorts of ways, and it might be because so many offenders, when they are, say, sober and when they are great, they're just lovely people.
And when they're sorry.
But they're always so nice
when they're sorry.
Oh, and how many times I've heard, when he's sober, Narelle, he's the best husband or the best son or whatever.
Yeah. And also because I think sometimes Lorraine's parents' marriage was so solid, and so she came from a background of, you know, commitment to marriage. I think sometimes we overestimate the importance of that.
Yes.
You know, perhaps she was of a mindset that you, once you're married to someone, you start, you committed to that relationship.
I have no, that's very true. And, yeah. You know, some people, I would hope most people take that commitment, that marriage commitment, and they think, look, it's a bit of a rough patch.
That's right.
But we'll get through
ups
it.
Ups and downs,
yeah,
all that.
We'll go and get some counselling. But so often when they come back, it's like that honeymoon period for a couple of weeks and, pardon me, it all turns to shit again.
Yeah.
And it's those really lovely, great times that people hang on to and think we can get through this.
And we don't know what Murray was telling her about her responsibility in it all too. I'm sure he was somehow convincing Lorraine that she was responsible somehow. She was doing something to upset him or...
Yeah. He would say often, this is what Lorraine would tell her parents, that he would say to her that I got him angry, you know, the coffee didn't have a sugar in it, you know, just things like that. So that being vulnerable, she became even more vulnerable because
she
of...
She believed it.
Absolutely, yeah. And probably being teased and bullied in her younger years, she got to the point where she thought, this is my life and...
Yep. Oh, my goodness me. So they've been married about 12 months.
Yeah, so she also talked a lot to her mum and dad. They often rescued her. It got to the point sometimes Lorraine would go to a, you know, hitchhike to a local hotel somewhere in the middle of the night and ring her mum and dad and say, you've got to come and get me on. Anyway, they'd come and get her. She'd stay at home for a couple of days and then she'd go back with him. But he was very, very controlling too, like the finances. You know, Lorraine got a pension.
Mm.
She never saw it. And he would actually, quote, give her money, give her an allowance. It's like, excuse me, it's my bloody money. And, you know, I feel a bit bad in a way because Murray has family. And whenever you investigate from a police's point of view, you're coming in, you don't know anyone, you've got no allegiances to anyone. But Murray still had a family, as in a sister. I think he had a couple of siblings, but they loved him and they never thought that anything was wrong with Murray, you know. But we see a different side, a side that they cannot believe. Anyway, in 2002, Murray and Lorraine leave Cape Patterson and they go to northeastern Victoria. So they go into the country.
So they're moving slowly, progressively further from her family.
That's very good you picked that up.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Isolating her more and more.
Yeah.
So Cape Patterson had neighbours,
yeah,
you know, and it was a little bit of a community.
Yeah.
But then what they do is the family, Murray's family, have a rundown old farmhouse up in the middle of nowhere.
Mm.
It is about 6 km from the closest town. It's about, let's say 3 km from the closest neighbour. So really, if you are looking to isolate someone and be able to, pardon me, belt the shit out of them and have nobody hear what's going on, Murray has got her in the perfect position. The house was so run down that it didn't have gas, electricity or water, because it was just an old shack really, but that was connected so that they could live there. It was a hole.
Mm.
It was awful, but it was the isolation. When you drive down this driveway, 500 metres from the road, it was like, oh, it was almost creepy.
Ugh.
So Alan and June, they've received so many calls from Lorraine, and she actually said at one point there that she was scared that Murray would actually kill her.
Mm.
There was one time there where she stated to her mum that he'd tried to choke her and that she'd wet herself. She was that frightened. On the 9th of July of 2002, so they've moved in. They haven't been up there very long, maybe 6 months at the most. June rings Lorraine, and Lorraine's only got her mobile phone. That, as I said, that is her security blanket. And June rings Lorraine to say that there's been a death of a family friend, and Lorraine didn't have enough money to go and buy a card. So she asks her mum, can you send a card on my behalf? And this is the last time her mum ever spoke to her.
Mm.
For a week, they don't, you know, that. I mean, I don't think it's unusual that they didn't speak to Lorraine for a week, remembering that she's doing every day.
Yeah.
But Murray has taken such control of her. On the 16th of July, which is the week later, Murray rings June and Alan and says, have you heard from Lorraine? June and Alan immediately are very, very concerned. Mm. And they've said, well, no, but what's happened? And he said, oh, she walked out on me yesterday, threw a cup of coffee over me, said, I've had enough of you bastards. And she walked out with a little calico handmade bag that June had made for her. But he said she didn't have her mobile phone, didn't take her medication. And that's what concerned June and Alan. Because number one, she'd never go anywhere without her phone.
Mm.
And Lorraine's not going to walk out. Like, where's she going to go?
Mm.
But he also said that she had $150 cash.
Mm.
June and Alan couldn't work that out because she didn't have enough money to buy a card the week before. And she hadn't been paid by Centrelink. So Alan is so concerned. But that night, the 16th of July, he rings the Knox police station and reports her missing. Because they just knew, you know, that intuition?
Yeah.
That feeling. And he rings the station and they obviously contact the local police up with her and they go and see Murray and Murray gives them, the local police up there, the same story that she'd, you know, left him. But then another policeman goes around the next day and he says to him that he'd she'd had an affair and left him. Like, there was a lot of different stories. And he also said she had $190, not $150. Like, all these different scenarios. Anyway, on the 18th of July, so this is, we believe she was went missing on the 15th of July. Murray rings the parents on the 16th. On the 17th is when Alan reports her missing.
Yep.
The 18th, which is 3 days after she's gone missing, Murray attends Centrelink and he requests a single person's pension.
Oh.
Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
He says that his wife's left him. That's all he said. But you do get, I mean, I don't know this, but you'd get more money as a single person on Centrelink than you do as a married person. We also know that on that day he withdrew Lorraine's pension, $350 Centrelink pension, from a bank that she'd never ever withdrawn her money from.
Mm.
So he gives differing accounts of, you know, what she said. He also tells us that, oh, we go up and see him 3rd of September.
Okay.
So it's 2 months after she goes missing, not four.
Mm-hmm.
Are you starting to, is that 2 months acceptable?
No, that's not
a lot
bad.
More acceptable than four.
I'm still stressed about everything he could do in that time, but there's so much has happened.
Yeah.
Now in the last 40 minutes that I'm just like, oh, my God, Paul Lorraine.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm just like really invested in this story because you're such a good storyteller. I can't wait for you. I'm on the edge of my seat, literally. I can't wait for you to meet Murray. That's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for Narelle to meet Murray.
Okay.
Mm.
I am getting there.
Okay, so 2 months after all this has happened.
And just one before going on, Murray grew up in this area where they've got this rundown farmhouse.
Yes,
so he knows the place back to front, right? You hearing me?
Yes.
Okay. The 3rd of September is when we take over.
Right.
Missing persons take over. And we go up there and we talk to him.
To the shack?
We go to, I don't know if I could even call it a shack.
Mm.
Oh, my God. It was so cold. Oh, it just, it was creepy.
Mm.
And I kept thinking she's under the floorboards. I have no idea why. But apparently because she was so little, I don't think she'd be all that hard to get rid of.
Mm.
And when I saw Murray, when we knocked on the door, Murray, oh, I think he had a hat on, a cowboy hat sort of thing. I didn't like him from the minute I saw him. Now, I must admit, I do go there. I think he's done it. But remember that parachute theory, you got to keep your mind open.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was very accommodating initially. And then when we started to sort of drill down and just ask him a couple of questions, he started to get a bit antsy, a bit sort of rude. And I think in the end he actually asked us to leave. And I remember we came back with a warrant. I don't know when that was, but it might have been, like it would have been within, you know, 24 hours.
Right.
And I do remember saying to him, I shouldn't say this, but I do remember saying to him, I know you've done it, Murray, and I'm going to fucking find her. And, you know, and I never did. It's one of the biggest regrets of my career.
What did he say when you said that, though?
He said he didn't do it.
Mm.
You're wrong. He was very confident that we wouldn't find, you know, that he hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
But I also think knowing the place, my gut feeling is he did it, and I told him that. But if somebody told me that and I hadn't done it, I think I would be, how dare you speak?
Of course.
It was almost like you find her. You know, that really cocky, obnoxious, smart-ass. I think it's fairly obvious I never liked him.
Yeah. I think it was after you said that, yeah.
Was
I think you got the message that day. Yeah.
However, even though, and I can say with my hand on my heart, I couldn't stand him. But I also thought maybe he hasn't murdered her and maybe I'm on the wrong track.
Yeah.
So I've got to put that bias behind me because otherwise I couldn't do my job. Mm. Because otherwise everything I did, I'd be looking for somewhere, something to nail him. You don't actually look anywhere else but trying to nail him. So I was very aware I didn't like him. And also, I don't know what it is about me and people with vulnerabilities. I think we all feel very protective of them, but with Lorraine I felt particularly attached in a strange sort of way because I was her age, just a little bit, and 12 months younger.
Yeah.
But I always felt June and Lorraine, they adored me.
Parents, June and Alan.
Yeah. But you know what? I adored them.
Yeah. No, you've painted a really sweet picture. I'm the same. I'm feeling really emotional about this case, about this girl who's very vulnerable. We keep using that word, and these parents who loved her, and just this bloody rotten luck of running into this person at the caravan park.
Yep. And, you know, as parents, I imagine you would probably... You could almost blame yourself, couldn't you, for thinking, did I let her go? But you got to, you know.
And doing this podcast, you do, you run into people who blame themselves for all sorts of things, like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting. So we get up there the 3rd of September and I'm not sure, but it would have been within 24 hours that we do the warrant. And I thought it was interesting that we found out a couple of days later that on the 4th of September... The day after we'd been up there, Murray had gone to a pawn shop and tried to pawn Lorraine's jewellery. Yeah. Can you get your head around that?
No.
This is a supposed devastated, you know, man that's lost his wife. He doesn't know where she is. Mm. He hasn't rung any of her friends. Mm. He hasn't the only person he's rung to find out where Lorraine is her parents, but that's a, you know, a smoke screen,
yeah,
in my view, absolutely. So, but he's pawned her jewellery.
How weird.
Yeah, yeah. So we have no evidence to suggest that she's alive after the 15th of July. And we do Centrelink checks, DHS, immigration, Medicare, births, everything.
You're also checking in the house, once you've got a warrant, not only are you checking for a body, but you're also checking for any signs of violence in the house. So you've got no signs of that anyone's died in there.
Nope, nothing. Okay. What we do find in a little bag that's in amongst all the, pardon me, the shit in the bloody cupboard was Lorraine's little calico bag.
That he reckons she took with her.
Yep, yep. We found that. That's the only thing we found really of any significance. Mm. We went over the place with luminol. We pulled up floorboards, which he was very upset about. And I understand he was upset, but I sort of think we have a we have a responsibility to try and find Lorraine and really work out what's happened. Is she missing or is she murdered? Although by this stage we're pretty sure that she's been murdered. So we find the calico bag. But what we also do is with the vacuum cleaner, we take the contents of the vacuum cleaner because we're thinking maybe he's vacuumed everything up.
Yeah.
You know, we never found any evidence, nothing. And I went up with search and rescue up in a chopper.
Yep.
We had a chopper that went up because they lived right near a river and we thought maybe he'd put her in the river.
Yep.
So we did the chopper. We went on a little boat trying to find her. Never found
anything.
Nothing. But I think to myself, if it was Murray, and I'm pretty sure it was, that she was very little.
Yeah.
And he knew the place back to front. He would know all those, you know, when you grow up somewhere and you know all those little nooks and crannies. I'm hoping one day that somebody will, you know, find her. Just a bit of closure for her parents. Well, not closure, but, you know.
Yeah. All of that then suggests a sort of a premeditated murder, doesn't it? More so than a bashing gone too far.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what I was assuming.
Yeah, you'd assume maybe that there might be some blood splatter.
Yeah.
That there might be...
I was assuming that anyway, given the violence of their relationship, that there would be that in the house anyway.
No. And, you know, sometimes you've just got to accept there's no evidence.
Yeah.
You know?
Frustrating.
We did everything we could and we never found anything. So then the following year, and we go and see Murray a lot. I'd go close to saying we probably nearly arrest him.
Yeah, right.
And I said to him a number of times, I know you've done it, you prick. I did, because that's how I felt. I thought, oh, look, you know, I'm not going to pretend. I felt I wanted to find Lorraine just for her mum and dad. Oh, and that's another thing. Her mum and dad have a memorial service for Lorraine and they asked me to go, which I thought was just lovely. And it was a beautiful service. And I can remember I sat up the back and Alan, in his eulogy, he made mention of me and how wonderful I'd been. Well, the tears welled up and I was so embarrassed because here I am, this homicide detective, you know, that's, you know, I'm going to get you, you prick.
Yeah.
And I've got tears. Oh, I was so embarrassed, but I just couldn't control it, you know.
Yeah.
I just felt so bad. But anyway, on the 9th of July 2003, we got information that Murray had committed suicide. I don't know much about it other than he left a note, and the note basically said, how dare you treat me like this and my sister who lived near him. And he said, I didn't kill Lorraine. And just a little bit of a tiny little bit, I'm thinking to myself, if he did kill her, wouldn't, and you've got nothing to hide because you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
I wonder whether you would say,
yeah,
actually, I did do it. Or you were so stoic saying, no, I didn't do it, and you just had to stick to your guns. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that little bit of a doubt, just a tiny bit.
I bet. Well, I mean, what else could have happened? I mean, it's unlikely, but is it possible that she walked out the door?
Absolutely.
Without all her stuff?
It's possible.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. Look, you know what else we looked at? Had she been picked up by a hitchhiker?
Yeah.
Had she walked out the door? And this is what I mean. You've got to keep that. Even though I thought he was a prick and that he'd done it.
Yeah.
You still have to go down every burrow, every rabbit burrow, just to make sure. But everything pointed to Murray. Yeah. Everything.
And you can't assume people are acting logically. You can't assume a man who's about to kill himself is thinking logically when he writes his note. You can't assume that a woman who's being bashed to smithereens every day of her life is acting logically, I guess. You can't assume logic everywhere.
No, you can't. And also remembering that Murray had an aneurysm and his behaviour completely changed.
Yeah.
So
did he remember? Did he? Who knows?
Yeah, but I remember because I had a look at the note and the note was very shaky and it was sort of a little bit all over the place, but you could actually see that he's saying, you know, how dare you treat me and my sisters like this. And I thought to myself, yeah, that'd be right. He's done that to pretend that, you know, he's so stressed and all that sort of stuff because it was
he could have said that for the sake of his sister. Maybe he so desperately doesn't want his sister to think that he killed Lorraine.
Mm. And I truly believe his family don't think he killed Lorraine. And I understand that. I get that. I'd think he did.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's easy for me to say because I'm removed.
Mm.
But just that tiny little bit of doubt.
Are June and Alan still living?
Yes. In fact, it's funny you say that. We have corresponded every year with Christmas cards.
Wow.
Every now and then they'll ring me just out of the blue. Gosh. But that's one thing I meant to say too is that when we took over the job on the 3rd of September, every single week after the 3rd of September, Alan would ring every Monday morning. And obviously he wanted to know if, you know, if anything had happened, but also it kept Lorraine in the front of our mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to dread Alan ringing because I felt so guilty and so responsible that once we did the basics and we realised that Murray had probably done it, other jobs come in every day.
Yeah.
Or maybe not every day, but you get the Wales Kings come in or something, and then you have to go and do something else. So only a couple
yeah.
get to do Lorraine's job and somebody else has to do something else. And, oh, the guilt, the dread that I had when Alan would ring, which is terrible because he was a lovely man, but the fact that I had to say, no, Alan, I'm sorry, we haven't been able to work on Lorraine this week because another – I mean, to yeah. actually say there's another job that's come in.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. like how – it's hard for Alan and June to hear that their daughter would take precedence, and of course she would.
Yeah. But at least you could say it nicely. I've heard on other podcasts families accused of harassing police for ringing once a week
about their cases. Oh, I understood completely, but.
Yeah.
Oh, and you know, you could almost set your watch on it. You know, say 20 past eight Monday morning, and it'd go, and it'd be my direct line. Oh, no. God love them. Yeah. No, I only rang them last week. They live down Port Arlington way, I think, now.
Yeah.
And they've done, like, Love Lorraine days and, like, they're very proactive with Lorraine. Like, it's – yeah, because they just don't – they don't want people to ever forget her. You know, you can't help but – and, you know, they're spokespeople for family violence and
– it's so interesting, isn't it, how people tend to go one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they have become very proactive yeah. and
I suppose she's their only child. She's still their life.
Absolutely.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.